Welcome, everyone. This is The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, December 13th, 2008. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and I am glad today to host a discussion on the topic, Shut Down Londonistan Before It Blows Up the World. Now, with me here in the studio is our Executive Intelligence Review Counterintelligence co-editor, Michelle Steinberg. Welcome, Michelle.
Hi, Marcia.
Who everybody knows from being on the show and hosting many times in recent years. But I'm glad to say we have off-site two people to discuss this topic, one of which from Stockholm in Sweden is the, among many other things, the Arab Language Coordinator of the Executive Intelligence Review International Operations, which you can see on LaRouchePub.com. But I'm glad to welcome Hussein Askari. Welcome, Hussein.
Thank you, Marcia. I'm also glad to be with you and with Michelle.
And from the LaRouche Political Action Committee, LaRouche Youth Movement Center, which includes a war room, editorial, and other operations, welcome Ben Denniston.
Hi, good to be here.
So, as I mentioned about Londonistan, that this must be shut down, we can understand that that we would have a show or a focus on this, given what happened in Mumbai, India, over the November 26th, 29th period of fierce terrorism and death there. But inclusive of that, in fact, this just throws the spotlight on networks interconnected with the British Empire, with the United Kingdom, the Saudi Kingdom, and with operations going back for not just decades, you could say centuries. And the reason we especially want to talk about this now is the gravity of the world collapse. The activation of this kind of terrorism means we either go into a guaranteed dark age, already the lights have gone out, or we have to use this as a turning point opportunity. Now, let me just mention a couple of things about what Mr. LaRouche and his wife and associates have been up to, because they were in India, and then our guests can kick off the discussion right away. And what I'm referring to is the first part of December, for a week to 10 days, Mr. LaRouche, his wife Helga Zepp LaRouche, Jeff Steinberg, Michelle's co-editor on counterintelligence, were in India for a series of private and public meetings, a seminar, at least one seminar, on all aspects of the strategic situation. This is all part of how Mr. LaRouche has been leading the charge for coalescing and for prompting an initiative of the major powers, the four, the United States, Russia, China, and India, to launch the kinds of collaboration for economic recovery, for leading the way out of this constant strife and terrorism. And so I just want to point out that you can find an article by LaRouche. Actually, his speeches are being edited, and same with Helga Zepp LaRouche and Jeff Steinberg. They will be posted on the EIR website, www.larouchepub.com, within the next 72 hours. But even sooner, Mr. LaRouche, when he left India, began on December 9th an article called The Gravest Moment of Crisis in Modern History. And that is also co-headlined The Dynamics of Terrorism, A View from Delhi. And that, if it isn't posted now, I think will be on the LaRouche Political Action Committee website very shortly. And this is where Mr. LaRouche is stressing the points I just made about the fact that we need this emergency historic policy shift. And also he certainly goes into the British Empire, what he means by that and who's doing what to whom. And with that, let me just go ahead and ask you, Hussein Askari, if you would kick off the discussion, because I think for the last, how many, Michelle, 15 years or more, at different times, you have sounded, you have used the expression Londonistan. You have pointed to these characters in London, a Lord Avebury and many others, who are literally backing and fostering terrorism. Would you begin with giving us that overview?
Yes. Well, first of all, I mean, the term Londonistan was invented by a French professor after the metro bombings in Paris in 1995. Because it was revealed later that all the planners and the ones who conducted the attack were in London. Now, that's what is most frustrating, because most governments in the world know that international terrorism is fostered and used out from London. So the thing is, I mean, if anybody wants to fight international terrorism seriously, the people to talk to Mr. Lyndon LaRouche and us, because we have written the book about international terrorism. And as you may, you will find out in this program, and we will talk more about the what people always demand is empirical evidence about how Britain is running, or the British Empire is running, international terrorism. We can present the concrete, but the concrete evidence. But the issue is what Mr. LaRouche has pointed out, is first, what is the situation in the world today with the financial and economic disintegration of the world? What does that mean for the globalization empire, the British Empire, which is globalization? And why and how the British have used and are manipulating that as a way of getting around the solution, which will require that sovereign nation states, especially the major powers, the United States, India, China, and Russia, get together to establish a system based on sovereign nation states, not world government, not empires. And that in itself is the biggest threat to the British Empire, a financial system. But also people have to really understand what LaRouche means by the British Empire, because they're not simply money and intelligence people and killing and weapons. These are instruments, but what the British Empire is really, as LaRouche has defined it, is a way of thinking, too. And that's why Mr. LaRouche, all the time, he points to these, the problem with the methods of thinking, scientific, historical thinking, with people all over the world today. Now, before I go into the details of the why and how the British, because the British have used religion for more than 250 years now, as they were a global empire controlling many nations and many religions, especially exactly as the Roman Empire did, by studying these religions, but studying them in order to manipulate them through the policy of to divide and conquer. Now, the problem today is you cannot solve the problem with international terrorism. You cannot defeat the British Empire unless what LaRouche is pointing at as the method and the context in which these methods are being used is understood by people. But there is one big issue, which is nobody in the world today can defeat the British Empire other than the United States itself, as difficult that might sound. Because all the other nations, for different reasons, which we can maybe go through now or another point, is either for corruption or other problems, they cannot deal with the British by themselves, like even the major powers, Russia, India, China, because they tend to be more pragmatic and make deals how to solve these problems. Now, the British commit a crime in some country, like what happened with Benazir Bhutto, and the week after, they offer to help Pakistan in the investigation. So what they're going to do is to cover up the evidence that the trail leads to London. The same thing now, Gordon Brown wants to go to India to talk about fighting terrorism. Now, this is a problem, especially with former British colonies or nations who are British colonies. But the ones who can deal really with this problem, I mean, either these nations gang up today against the British. They boycott the British government. They boycott British institutions as a group of nations, or the best solution, if the new administration in the United States deals with this seriously, they throw the book at the British and demand that this thing is being is resolved. And therefore, it's very interesting when you look at the evidence for different operations and like fundraising, planning, and things. The most credible evidence, and which the British usually react to, because is from the U.S. administration, from the especially the finance treasury, because the British don't have to react to anybody else in the world. They can solve their problems with others in a different way. But with the United States, they have to do something. And that's a very important factor. So in the coming weeks and months, the new U.S. administration will have to play a crucial role in this. And that's what Mr. LaRouche and the LaRouche movement is focused on, which is the correct thing.
Okay.
Now, to go back into the...
I'd like to just pick up on that point a little bit, if I could, on what the current situation here in the U.S. is and how we're dealing with it. And it's a pleasure to work with this EIR team. The LaRouche Youth Movement is going to get involved in documenting some of this Londonistan information on video. It'll be on the LPAC TV. But let me start with something that we are getting to the new administration, the new Congress, the transition team, which is the December 12th, 2008 issue of Executive Intelligence Review, which is called Expose British Intelligence Role Behind the Mumbai Massacre. And in this, it begins with Lyndon LaRouche's piece, British Intelligence is Behind Mumbai Massacre, and then a review of and reprinting of some of the EIR's most critical pieces in documenting this, such as the year 2000 memorandum prepared for delivery to then U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, a request to launch an investigation pursuant to placing Great Britain on the list of states sponsoring terrorism. 8 years have come and gone. Many, many more people have died, including the 9/11 massacre, the London subway bombing, the French subway bombing, the Mumbai train bombings in which nearly 1,000 people were killed or injured, and so on all the way through November the 26th. This documentation, this EIR, which includes reference to a dozen or so articles that Hussein Askari himself has written over the years, going back to 1995 on London's Afghansi. This is vital reading for the new administration. Now, so, Marcia, if I can, I want to tell people you can call EIR, order your EIR subscription or single issues. Every citizen needs to know about this. Our toll-free number is 1-800-278-3135. 1-800-278-3135. And I think with Senator Clinton, Hillary Clinton, becoming the Secretary of State, with General Jim Jones becoming the National Security Advisor, the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, who... you know, really kicked the neocons out of Washington to a certain extent. Now we can finish the job, and I think we absolutely must do this. One final thing I want to say, because a lot of our discussion is going to be about the Saudis and Islamic fundamentalism. But in doing this current review, which is going to be really, really expanded, including to show how the international terrorist phenomenon, the London-created problem, is completely one and the same with the international drug traffic, the center of which right now is Afghanistan. You've got the major armies of the world. You've got NATO. You've got the British Army. You've got the American Army. Not just armies, but military services in Afghanistan right now. And opium production has gone from 2,000 tons in 2001 to 8,000 tons in 2007, with every major military in the world there. So there is a deliberate decision by the financiers, don't touch the drug traffic. This is what we've got to stop. Now, the second point I want to make is this is not about Islamic terrorism, because in the assassinations which we have traced, the assassination of Indira Gandhi. The radical Sikh elements, where were they protected and kept? London. The assassination of Rajiv Gandhi, her son, by the Tamil Tigers. Where did they get their funds, their support, their publicity? London. The assassination of Ali Bhutto. I'm sorry, that's a different question. Ali Bhutto is the father of Benazir Bhutto. He was killed by Henry Kissinger and Zia-ul-Haq and the British in a different way for being a nationalist leader in 1978. Benazir Bhutto, who was killed a year ago, she was going to be the incoming prime minister of Pakistan. She was killed by fundamentalist terrorists out of London. So India and Pakistan are not enemies in this. And one of the most important things is a collaboration between the two countries against their common enemy. So, we really have the goods on this. And I can only say again what Hussein said. If you want to fight terrorism, be in touch with Lyndon LaRouche and us. Otherwise, you're not serious. So, Hussein, back to you.
Yeah, thank you. No, that's the point. Well, there is one more point is that, you know, this is about, it's not about Islam or Islamic people. I mean, these terrorist networks are mostly despised and hated by normal Muslims around the world because most of their victims are Muslims. Remember that. It's not Christians or Jews who are the biggest victims. They have destroyed many Muslim nations, killed Muslim people. But so this is not the issue. The issue is the manipulation of religious and ethnic groups. As Michelle said, there are Sikhs, there are Hindus, there are Tamils, there are all kinds of groups. Now, just to get back to the because if you don't understand the history of the British Empire and the nature of the British Empire, you will not understand what's going on today. And therefore, the background or the answer to the question Marsha said in the beginning is, the history of the British manipulation of religion in the region, especially Southwest Asia, is basically, you know, there are two reasons. First of all, the first time the British came into the region in the 19th century, in the middle of the 19th century, and they established alliances with tribal leaders where there were no nation states. But later, after World War I, the issue became nation-states or the empire, and it became more emphatic after Franklin Roosevelt's intervention during World War II, whether you will have empires or nation-states, a world order based on one of these two models. So before, after World War I, because that was also one of the weak points of the British Empire, because it was going economically bankrupt, is that the rise of nationalist movements in Southwest Asia, especially in Egypt. They had problems with Ataturk in Turkey. So the reason they chose the Islamic card is that because religion, the people are attached to religion in these areas, and also there were no nation states before that. You had the Ottoman Empire, which was a religious, Islamic religious empire. So people's attachment to religion was like attachment to some sort of a nationalism. But they opted for that because in every part of Southwest Asia, whether in Iraq, in Iran, in Jordan, where Jordan didn't exist at the British created, but like Syria, Palestine, Egypt, North Africa, and even in other parts of Africa, you had the rise of nationalism, people who wanted to become free from the British Empire. Now, this became a very strong passion in these regions because this was a system of slavery. And people went through World War I, and they were hoping to get freedom and independence after that. Of course, the people did not get the help they hoped to get from the United States because you had a British sympathizer in the White House, Woodrow Wilson. But you had a very strong nationalist movement for independence from the British in many countries, especially in Egypt. So the British, what they did is they invented what we now know as the Muslim Brotherhood, of Islamic, more religious movements rather than nationalist movements as a way to defeat the nationalists because they could easier mobilize the population because of their strong attachment to religion. Now, this worked to a certain extent until World War II, but with Roosevelt's intervention in this part of the world, and Roosevelt's intention, Franklin Roosevelt's intention for the world after World War II, that there will be a system of sovereign nation states who are working together for development and freedom. Now, in that case, of course, everybody knows the story that Franklin Roosevelt died too early, but the nationalist movements in the region were still growing. And you had revolts, you had even military resistance against the British. But what happens is the most critical period when Gamal Abdel Nasser and the Egyptian Republican officers, they make the revolt against the puppet king of Egypt, King Farouk, who was a puppet of the British. And then Abdel Nasser decides to nationalize the Suez Canal, which was still a British property. Then the British launched this war against Egypt with the collaboration of France, which was still colonial, and Israel. But Eisenhower, the U.S. president, who was working in the same line, not as strong, but in the same line of Franklin Roosevelt, actually supported the Egyptians against the British, French, and Israelis, and forced them to retreat because they were bombing the Egyptian cities brutally. And that shifted the situation against the empire in favor of Republican nation-state systems. Now, that shook the British very strongly. So the British reactivated the Muslim Brotherhood to attack and try to defeat Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt and other movements. There was another case, like in Yemen, when Abdel Nasser supported also a Republican revolution against a feudal king, a sultan, in Yemen in 1961. And actually, the Republicans in Yemen got support very unexpectedly from John F. Kennedy, not support in terms of military or any other support, but that they were recognized as a new independent nation by the United States. So that was a big, a major defeat to the British. And the British mobilized. Of course, they went to the feudal leaders. And that's the other reason they choose Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and other the rich Gulf states, because these are feudal systems which are favored by the British itself, oligarchical, semi-feudal system. They understand each other better, because there you don't have accountability, you don't have democracy, you don't have freedom. And the leaders, their whims decide the fate of the nation and the policy of the nation. So through the Saudis, the British tried to bring back this king back to Yemen, and there you had a big war going on. And the British provided the weapons for the Saudis and this Sultan Yemen. So anyway, that failed. But the thing, what became the strategy is, instead of having sovereign nationalist movements in the region, you would create religious movements, because religious, like Islam, you know, you can go all the way from Morocco at the Atlantic coast to Indonesia in Asia, but there are no borders, there are no nation states. So you create a so-called pan-Islamic sentiment and political movement, which actually serves the idea of the empire, because you would not have independent sovereign nations in that sense. And also in the 60s, you had the emergence of the non-alignment movement, which is strongly nationalist movement against colonial and imperial policy. And in that situation, in 1969, these Israeli extremists, they burned the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is a great symbol for Muslims all over the world. And then you have the pretext for a pan-Islamic revolt. And now the enemy is no longer the British Empire, which actually still existed as a colonial power in the region. Britain was no longer the enemy. It became Israel. And due to U.S. support to Israel, the United States became the enemy, especially since 1973 and the oil crisis, instead of the British. So the British were standing in the background while this religious these religious sentiments were being fed by fanatics on both sides. And that was the time frame when you had the organization of the Islamic Conference being established, and also you had, in preparation in that period, the war against the Soviet Union, because what the British did is they mobilized Islamic movements in all these Muslim countries against the nationalists. So they said these nationalists are not really nationalists. They are communists. They are God-denying communists working with the Soviet Union, not because they want independence from the British Empire, but because they are communists. That's the reason they are revolting against the British Empire. And they used that factor that anybody who was fighting against the British Empire was a communist. And, of course, that happened during the Cold War, and it was easy to get people even in Western Europe and the United States against these nationalist movements by calling them communists. And therefore, you had, with the outbreak of the Afghanistan war, where in Afghanistan you had a pro-Soviet regime in Afghanistan, and they managed to mobilize Muslim mujahideen or fighters from all the Muslim countries to fight the God-denying communists and the Soviet Union. And that's where you had the great outbreak of this militant form of Islamism, because before that you did not have, unless it was in Egypt with the Muslim Brotherhood, you had a militant group, but Islamism was not a militant force. And before the Afghan War in 1978-1979, and that's when the British intelligence and even the United States intelligence, the CIA and others, with the help of the Saudis and other Arab countries, they mobilized this great army of mujahideen to so-called liberate Afghanistan from the Soviet or the communists. And that becomes the new, a new force in world politics. But what happens when the Soviets are retreating after in 10 years later, in 89, is that the United States abandoned the whole operation simply because the objective was to defeat the Soviets there, give them a lesson. And what you had is an enormous infrastructure, which was financed by drugs and weapons trade, with all these Islamic mujahideen fighters, with a huge organization inside Pakistan and the military in place there. But the United States just withdrew, said, well, the mission is accomplished. So they left all these logistics, even the banking contacts, the weapon trade operations, the recruitment of Islamic mujahideen, they left all that for the British and the Saudis. And that's when, after 1890, you have the emergence of the so-called Al-Qaeda, because you will have all those mujahideen in Afghanistan who come from different Arab and Muslim countries going back to their countries. Now they become soldiers for hire in some way, and they spread all over the Arab countries, where you have this terrible situation in Algeria. You had operations in Egypt targeting everybody. A lot of them went to Bosnia to fight on the side of the Muslims against the Serbs. Everybody turned a blind eye to that, of course, at the time, because the Muslims were victims in that war. So anyway, you have a totally new generation, a new army, which could be deployed by whoever pays and controls these four international strategic control. And that's where the British seize this asset and use it and manipulate it. And all the documentation which EIR and the LaRouche movement have been presenting throughout the 90s, this is now the subject of these new investigations we are conducting. But that's the issue. It's the empire against nation states. That's why they want India and Pakistan to get at each other's throats. That's why they want Morocco and Algeria to get at each other's throat. Iraq and Iran, Turkey and Iran, Syria and Lebanon. By using the same asset, it has become a strategic asset for British intelligence. And all the evidence that's necessary has been provided. What is needed now is action. Of course, people have to understand this history, but what is needed now is action by governments, especially in the United States, to put a stop and an end to this dangerous strategy, which can get us into wars and maybe even nuclear war in the case of India and Pakistan.
Let me ask one thing from any of you. The part of the mechanisms, you could call it indoctrination, you could call it immersion, the recruitment and mobile deployment of people into this anti-nation state operations, not even just terrorism, but just constant lifelong commitment. Is that where what you've been exposing about some of the so-called charities come in with setting up centers and schools and camps, Hussein?
Yes, well, you have that the, you had two levels of this operation. You had people coming in from Muslim countries during the Afghan War. These are generally well-off people, like al-Zawahiri, like bin Laden, who are the leaders of al-Qaeda. They're coming from wealthy families. But what happens when you need to recruit a large army and also a pool, an infrastructure where you can operate and recruit? Because what happens in Pakistan, Kashmir, and Afghanistan is that you had whole regions support logistical and intelligence background for the terrorist movements or organizations. But these populations are very poor. So you need not only to go in with religious indoctrination, you need to go in with financial economic aid. These are very, very poor regions. They really need aid. They need development. But the problem is that this money is coming through so-called charity, Islamic charity organizations, like this, the ones created by the Saudis, especially since the Afghan War started in 1978. There are lots of charity organizations were established to go in very, very poor regions with food, clothing, building houses and schools. But with that goes in this Wahhabi Salafi ideology, which, I mean, one can go through that in more in detail, but that's another story. But it's a fundamentalist ideology which is mixed with anti-Western, anti-American, generally, brainwashing. So you create whole regions. Now we have on the border Waziristan and the border with India. All these regions are supporting Islamic or different types of terrorist groups because they bought the sympathy of the population who were in need for that type of help. The same thing happened in Chechnya, in Central Asia, in Bosnia, because those people could not get any support from anywhere else. So these so-called charities go in there and you know, bring people food and clothing and housing and schools and so on. So it's a very well-paid operation. Then the other level of operations you have is that is generally in Britain itself, you have all these schools, so-called Islamic schools, where, I mean, not all of them, but a great deal of them. I mean, you look at every case of terrorists recruited in Britain, they were recruited and educated in these schools. Not schools, these are mosques. But these are training camps in a certain way, ideological and even for weapons, like the Finsbury Park Mosque, where this man, Abu Hamza al-Misri, was educating and training young people. Abu Hamza al-Misri was himself in Afghanistan war and was trained by British and maybe even U.S. intelligence to how to make bombs, how to use weapons, how to use modern telecommunication equipment and so on. These were being trained in Finsbury Park Mosque in Britain, in London. So you have this other level, and most of the recent operations, both targeting the United States or targeting Britain or other European countries, these are young people who are indoctrinated in these Islamic mosques or schools in Britain itself. And there are also in other European countries, but it's more controlled there. But in Britain, they have full freedom, working under the nose of the Internal Intelligence, Secret Intelligence Agency, MI5, and British police. And that's a well-known. These people work freely there. They recruit, they raise funds, and so on. Only in critical moments, those groups come under scrutiny by the British government. And usually this happens when the United States starts to complain. When Egypt or India or even Russia complain, nothing happens. But when the United States raise questions about activities happening in Britain, Then you have some investigation. Some of these places are shut down. Some people are arrested. Their bank accounts are in Barclays Bank, for example, are closed. Then you have action. And therefore, the U.S. Role is very crucial in this situation.
Yeah, one thing, the material you've already assembled, both over the years but in the last 2 weeks, as Michelle said, in EIR, it's so impressive to look again when President Mubarak in Egypt complained many times, I think after the Luxor bombing is one I remember.
Yes.
In India, Manmohan Singh specifically listed people and complained. And the snubbing and the arrogance, you know, these are just ignored, I guess, Michelle. Is that what you'd say?
Well, there's a lot of double talk that goes on. The British government has been sitting on a demand from the Indian government since 2003, names, organizations, etc., help us find these terrorists. And the British are not afraid of the United States anymore. I think it's the role of our movement and inside the United States in the fight for the American system, which is a system of a world community of sovereign nation states. The tradition of John Quincy Adams, of Benjamin Franklin, the founder of our republic, of FDR's good neighbor policy, what Lyndon LaRouche brings about rekindles. This is what will scare the British. And I have a question of Ben and the limb in the war room and so forth in terms of how do you see us being able to affect this situation through the youth activity?
One thing we've been escalating out here has been the usage of our website, the LaRouchePAC.com website, which has been in kind of a transition phase over the last year or so, and now it's really beginning to pick it up as a real mass outreach, mass organizing tool where we can just get this kind of analysis, you know, get LaRouche's analysis and get this kind of, you know, competent historical strategic assessment of where we're standing right now. If we can get that out to the population in a, you know, timely and coherent manner. And one thing we've been increasing with in attempting to do this, and frankly in dealing with the population that's been, put it bluntly, dumbed down to a large degree through popular culture these days, through the status of the current media, the current educational system. We've been really escalating the work on putting out certain video product, whether they be, you know, longer video, like full documentary type compositions running anywhere from an hour to 2 hours, or whether they be shorter 5, 10 minute, 15 minute kind of video shorts. We're really trying to get a constant stream of high-quality analysis and marching orders coming through the website to really lead the way in this. And it's just crucial point. I mean, I think it's worth reemphasizing. It's been said, but, you know, all this is in the context where we're at the complete end of this current system. You know, we're at the point where this system of, you know, what's called globalization, but this British imperial system is at its very last end phase. And it's at a point where if the British try to continue to keep the world under the yoke of this collapsing system that can no longer sustain a population of the world of 6.5-7 billion people, like this system just physically can no longer even sustain that level of population, even at this massive amount of poverty that exists today, it's going to require just a major collapse in global civilization and population. And Mr. LaRouche has estimated a collapse down to 1 to 2 billion people over the course of a couple generations. And the obvious opposition to that, as has been discussed, is the moves of certain nations to assert their sovereignty and move away from this system that resembles this British imperial system and go with what Mr. LaRouche has been proposing, with the system of sovereign nations modeled on the intention of Franklin Roosevelt. So we're trying to really make sure people are just constantly aware of where we're at historically right now. We're just at such an incredible branching point, so to speak. We have to make a decision whether we're going to slide into a new dark age with the collapse of this system, or whether we're going to actually shake off and crush this British imperial system and move with LaRouche's four powers solution and cooperation towards economic development and progress globally. And so we're trying to keep the website as the way to reach millions of people and get people organized and recognizing that's where we're at historically, and get people fighting and mobilizing and thinking from that standpoint. So that's, and in respect to that, we're going to be putting out some video product to addressing this situation be discussed right now. But one thing I had a question, I think I have to ask it to Michelle, is looking at this whole, this you mentioned at the beginning, that you got to look at, in reality, there's no such thing as this Islamic terrorism as such, as it's discussed today, as somebody like George Bush will attempt to understand it or tell it to people. It doesn't exist. And the point that it's not separated from the international drug trade. I'd like to hear if you could elaborate on that aspect to the this imperial slime mold.
Sure. We could begin at various points. Hussein mentioned the Afghan Holy War. That was a miserable operation by the United States in the middle of the 1980s, when already the financial system was in the beginning phase of the collapse. The financial system is dead now. It's dead, dead, dead. Every major central bank in the world is bankrupt. It's gone. They're printing money like there's no tomorrow, and if they have their way, there is no tomorrow. And so in the middle 1980s, Lyndon LaRouche had already organized countries who could not pay the international bankers, the International Monetary Fund, to think about declaring an international debt moratorium and put all the rotten, usurious debt aside and go for a growth in the real physical economy. One thing he did in 1982 was Operation Juarez with President López Portillo down in Mexico. Well, in the middle of that, and you also had a tremendous opportunity, which is on our website. The history of this is an excellent documentary that of the type Ben talked about. LaRouche had, through his dialogue, his personal relationship with President Ronald Reagan, had gotten Reagan to make an offer to the Soviets for the joint development of a space-based system that could render the threat of nuclear war obsolete. Well, the British wouldn't have that. The Cold War and mutual assured destruction had been their answer to Roosevelt's anti-colonial solution since Harry Truman, that son of a Bush, even before there was a Bush, this Bush family, there was Prescott Bush who put Hitler in power. So Truman was part of that tradition. I'm not kidding. But ever since Truman had dropped the atomic bombs on Japan, we were in the nuclear age, and the Brits were not going to let go of that. So they launched these other wars, and the Afghanistan Holy War, which was a atheist's war against a satanic war by British intelligence under religious cover against the Soviets. It was a proxy war that gave us the horrible army of terrorists that that Hussein described. Every Islamic terrorist phenomenon since the beginning of that Afghansi operation, which was around 1980, it really got launched. 79, I think, was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Every single major terrorist incident since then including 9-1-1 and including all of the other atrocities that you can think of, trace back to the Afghan Holy War, including Mumbai the other day, November 26, 2008. So how did it work? It works by, first of all, the British Empire has to regain control over the U.S. institutions, even if it's temporary. And they were able to do that with the Jimmy Carter administration in that came in 1976. Not through Jimmy Carter. You know, people who know Carter these days, he's taken some very heroic stands as an ex-president. As a president, he was not prepared at all. At all. And Brzezinski, Zbigniew Brzezinski, had a lot to do bringing this Central European oligarchic worldview to using oligarchic means, to including religious wars, to manipulate things. Now, let me take another cut of this whole situation. How and by the way, how was that Afghan war financed? Well, there's a character in Saudi Arabia by the name of Prince Bandar bin Sultan. He was the ambassador of he was the ambassador to the United States for about 20 years. And in the middle 1980s, he was the facilitator of a huge hundreds of billions of dollars deal between the British and British government and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, where Saudi Arabia would buy these Tornado jet fighters, but at an incredibly inflated price. Now, the British Empire has been bankrupt for a long time. And the original opium war that they ran against China and India was in the center of dope, money laundering, and protection of drug countries has always been part of the British Empire. We wrote about it in the book Dope Incorporated, which we first published in 1978 and updated two or three times. I think the last edition came out in 1992, in fact, where we were able to incorporate our understanding of the Afghan war and our understanding of Iran-Contra. So this Bandar bin Sultan was the recipient of bribes. Now, when you think of bribes, you know, $1 million could be a big bribe. This guy got $2 billion.
They call it a commission.
Pardon me?
The commission.
They call it a commission.
His commissions?
His commission. Yes. Oh, yes, not a bribe. Yes, the commission he received. Well, the Justice Department is investigating it as a bribe. Thank goodness for that. The commission, right. Not a couple of million dollars. $2 billion personally. Well, this was a slush fund. And these kinds of British-Saudi slush funds were used to finance the Osama bin Laden Mujahideen army in Afghanistan. And still continues today with these little satellite operations operating in Pakistan-controlled Kashmir, other places in Pakistan, and indeed inside India as well. The Saudis want to finance 2,000 to 4,000 madrasas inside India, that is, religious schools, from this same kind of charity operations. Now, let me tell you what LaRouche said while he was in India about this also, in answer to Ben's question on this Islamic terrorism. And this is really, really, really something. Lyndon said, just take 911. I know 911 was done by a British Saudi American operation on behalf of George Bush. I know that. We have the names and addresses. We have inside information from some of our intelligence friends who have done the inside job investigating this. We know it. Imagine the United States government under President George W. Bush, in conjunction with the Bush family friends, the Osama bin Laden operation staged using a British operation, the BAE operation, which is the British Saudi operation, with the largest single off-the-book funding in the world, ran this operation as a mechanism for making the Bush administration viable for the job assigned to it. Their job, make a mess of the world. And we find ourselves going into a situation where we take the potential of this kind of thing. For example, who runs the international drug operation? Who runs it? who has always run the drug operation, the British. What's Afghanistan? What's it growing drugs for what? For the world. And somebody interjected and said, India also. And Lynn said, well, it's the same thing. So I think that it's impossible in the next 9 minutes and 20 seconds to really give an answer to this. You know, maybe when our colleague Tanu Maitra, who was with LaRouche in India, gets back, we can do a follow-up show on this specifically, the interface between the international drug traffic and terrorism.
Yeah, do you want to add anything more to that, Hussein?
Yes, there was also answering Ben's question. You know, the answer to this problem is also, which is connected to this, it's integral part is solving the world economic financial crisis. If you bring economic development to Pakistan, to India, to Africa, to Southwest Asia, you solve this problem. But it will be solved in the under the supervision of sovereign independent nation states in the Westphalian spirit, the peace of spirit of the Peace of Westphalia. And I tell you, Mr. Lyndon LaRouche is the most popular American in Muslim countries. There's no dispute about that. And it has been for many years. When you talk about Islamic, people understand what he and we mean by Islamic. It's not the real Islam. It's not Islamic faith or anything. They know exactly what he talks about in a certain way. So this is not about, you know, attacking any religious or other belief, although there are problems in every culture. But the solution to the crisis, including the terrorism, is to going with the new Bretton Woods solution, the four powers solution with the new world economic and financial system. Now, one thing which is important in the education of people is the question of also classical education of people, because one important thing that to solve this problem is that people, especially in the United States, have to forget or to realize that Britain is not our ally. And I hear this from Americans the whole time. Britain is our ally, has always been our ally. And I will just tell you one thing again, the story of which William Shakespeare wrote about Othello. Oh, it's not about Othello, it's about the corruption of the Venetian system, how Venice manipulates people. And you look at the character of Iago, who manipulates everybody and leads everybody into a total disaster where a lot of people die and go commit suicide. Now, the problem is that every character in the Othello drama, they think Iago is their friend, is their ally. Why? Because he brings them secret information the whole time. He brings them insider information the whole time. Brings to Othello's wife, to the Othello's military officers, and so on and so forth. And he plays the friend of everybody. That's why the first thing to do is to make sure that people understand that our first enemy is the British Empire and whoever represents and defends that empire. It's like Gordon Brown. He's intending to go to India. Now, the problem is that if people think that he's a friend of India, that's the problem. If he goes to the United States and people receive him in the White House and say, this is our ally, that's the problem. Because you are having a relationship with Iago, who's going to kill you, who's going to kill your wife, who's going to kill your friends, and lead the whole country down. And that's one important lesson people have to understand from classical drama. The British are not your friend. They are not your ally. And it's time for people to realize that, especially in the United States.
So you mean when Tony Blair's new Faith Foundation comes knocking on your door, you know that he set up TonyBlairFaithFoundation.org. It's just what you're saying.
Yeah. Or he goes to the – now he's – the tragedy is that he's now the coordinator for the peace talks in Southwest Asia.
Yes.
Now, of course, a lot of people have rejected that idea because they know what kind of a – excuse my expression, what kind of a pig he has been. And therefore, he's not successful in being the so-called broker of peace in Southwest Asia. Nobody believes that joke. But a lot of people, maybe in Europe and the United States, believe that because that's right, because Tony Blair is the head of the four powers peace talks.
Yeah.
That's the United States, the EU, Russia, and you know, the other parties in the region. So the first thing is to recognize who is the enemy. And the enemy is not Islam, it's not Islamic, or that kind of thing. It's not Iran, it's not Hezbollah, it's not any group, but it's this British-created global strategic asset. It's the British Empire itself, which is now dying, as Michelle said, with the financial system, and just let go and help bury it.
Hussein, I think that that description of Iago and as the British Empire figure is really very powerful, and I never quite thought of it in that way, but maybe we should end up in the last few minutes talking about this principle of classical tragedy. Last week, we had Jerry Rose, Robert Beltran, Harley Schlanger do a special show on tragedy, and Ben has been part of the group from the War Room editorial, Lim editorial, and the Basement. You've had quite a few discussions with Lynn over the last month or so about the Iliad, Prometheus, the gods whispering in the ears of the mortals and driving them crazy, and how this leads to the tragedy of civilizations. And you take a combination, it seems to me you take a combination of things, both using classical drama as education as opposed to this horrible fundamentalism of all types, Jewish fundamentalism. It's insane. They killed, the Jewish fundamentalists killed Yitzhak Rabin, the man of peace of Israel. So everywhere you turn, you see that the fundamentalists are the best, Britain's best assassins in the world. The antidote to this kind of fundamentalism, new dark age, because that's what it is, it's a new dark age, is the right kind of education and economic development. And but this idea of cognition, the noosphere, as Vernadsky called it, and the role of culture in uplifting people, I think this is critical at this moment. So Ben, if you would tell us something about what Lynn's been doing in this regard.
It's been the, as I mentioned a little earlier, it's been the focus of a certain amount of the discussion, because in the, you know, there's this quote from the poet Shelley, and I don't have the exact quote off the top of my head, but it's really apt to the time we're at, where he said, in a time of great crisis, when people are, you know, forced to confront, and the fact that the ideas that they had believed in and what they had thought don't actually work, and they're not working in reality anymore, and they have to reassess some of their fundamental beliefs, when you get that effect in mass with a whole population or whole populations, those are times at which you can see populations accept new and profound ideas respecting man and nature. And so we're at such a point of, you know, as we've discussed, economic breakdown and crisis right now, that is a lot of the discussion here, and a lot of the discussion here has been around the using this LaRouchePack.com website specifically of how do we effectively introduce the kind of ideas that the population needs right now to uplift society, to deal with this profound existential crisis facing us. And so that's a big part of the discussion and studying here, is studying classical drama, classical poetry, and really getting at what a real human society is and how ideas are necessary for the development of populations, how to make that part of our political activity. So that's obviously an absolutely crucial point to what we're doing at this historical juncture we're at right now.
Well, I think with that, the time has flown by, and I'll have to thank you for this discussion, which I do very much, Ben Denniston, Hussein Askari, and right here with me, Michelle Steinberg. And as Michelle mentioned, our correspondent from India, Tanu Maitra, may well be on the show December 20th or December 27th. We talked to him about our topic today, and we will continue this discussion. Harley Schlanger will be with us December next week, December 20th. So I thank you all for the LaRouche Show, December 13th, 2008. This is Marcia Mary Baker. And thank you again. We want to see the end of Londonistan in the new year.